The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
On this question of fear, when I began writing these pages, I believed their subject to be children, the ones we have and the ones we wish we had, the ways in which we depend on our children to depend on us, the ways in which we encourage them to remain children, the ways in which they remain more unknown to us than they do to their most casual acquaintances, the ways in which we remain equally opaque to them. The ways in which, for example, we write novels just to show each other. The ways in which our investments in each other remain too freighted ever to see the other clear. The ways in which neither we nor they can bear to contemplate the death or the illness or even the aging of the other. As the pages progressed, it occurred to me that their actual subject was not children after all, at least not children per se, at least not children qua children. Their actual subject was this refusal even to engage in such contemplation, this failure to confront the certainties of aging, illness, death.
An excerpt from Joan Didion's memoir Blue Nights, released this week.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
After writing about the loss of her husband in her 2005 book, The Year of Magical Thinking, her latest deals with the death of her daughter. Loss of family, family rifts, dysfunctional families, from Hamlet via the Forsyte saga all the way up to the corrections, families have always proved fertile ground for writers, and in this week's programme we'll be endeavouring to find out why. We'll be hearing from Kevin Wilson about his novel of a family of performance artists, The Family Fang, and from Stefan Solzhenitsyn about the legacy of his legendary father, Alexander. But first, The Guardian's Richard Lee and Lisa Allardyce sat down to talk families with Jared Woodward. Woodward is best known for his trilogy of novels concerning the dysfunctional Jones family, the second of which, I'll Go to Bed at Noon, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 2004. And he can't seem to leave families alone. His new novel, Nourishment, is another family saga, this time with a dash of cannibalism thrown in.
In a 1925 essay about Catherine Mansfield, the novelist Willa Cather suggested that the simple relationships of loving husband and wife, affectionate sisters, children and grandmother are not down in the list of subjects from which the conventional novelist works. Do you think she's right, Gerard? Do you think that the novel was really focusing mainly on the individual before the 20th century?
I think that's probably true. If you think back to the novels written before that time, the Victorian novels, Dickens and so on, the family is really a backdrop for an individual sort of heroic performance. Although families have existed in literature before the 20th century, obviously. And you sometimes think of Hamlet as being one of the first fictional portrayals of a family in a sort of conventional sense. I mean, they're a royal family, obviously, but they're a family, and there's family ties going on, there's family jealousies.
The plot is indeed motored by the kind of family dysfunction.
Absolutely, and that sets up the whole idea of the sort of dysfunctional family, which is probably what the writer you mentioned was talking about in terms of the post-Freudian sort of interpretation of family.
I was thinking of Jane Austen. I'm wondering whether Pride and Prejudice is kind of a family novel.
The idea of a family is certainly very strong in it. It's all about relationships within families, the quest to start a family. And you couldn't really call it a family novel in the sense it's not about all the different members of the family given equal weight, which I suppose what you would call a family novel is a novel where the family, all the different members of the family, have their own story and their own desires and so on, and own frustrations and challenges, rather than it being one individual within that family.
Lisa, do you think it's important for a family novel to focus on a particular clan?
I think Gerard's defined a family novel brilliantly there versus one in which focusing on all the different characters. I mean, the family is, of course, such a rich source for the novelist. I mean, along with the Willa Cather quote, the other infamous quote about families in literature is, of course, Tolstoy, when he said, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way," which Gerard captures magnificently in his own work. And I mean, literature is strewn with unhappy families from Hamlet onwards.
And there's, of course, there's yourself, Gerard. Your trilogy, August, I'll Go to Bed at Noon, and The Curious Earth, follows the Jones family from 1955 until the mid-1980s. Was it always obvious to you right from the beginning that the family would be the matter for the novels?
Yes, I mean, I very much set out to write a novel about a family, closely based on my own family, openly admit. It's not as fictionalised as some might think. But yes, the key was to write about a family.
What was the attraction of family life for you as a novelist?
Writers often say that the subject chooses them, and that was certainly the case for me. In many ways, I didn't really want to write it, but feeling that it was there, that it had to be written about, I went ahead and did it eventually when I felt strong enough as a writer to do it. But you know, in a more general sense, I think what's attractive about writing about a family is partly the challenge of that thing I was saying earlier about following so many different characters. I mean, if you're writing about a family, you've got to start dealing with children and writing about children to a certain extent. You know, maybe you're writing about grown-up children, but you're still writing about two generations. That's not always very easy to do, and it's very interesting to do.
Is there that sense of a petri dish, a kind of experimental setup, because the family, the characters can't escape. They're always together but alone.
Yes, it's a sort of microcosm, and it's its own self-contained universe in which which has its own laws to a certain extent, and which becomes a sort of arena for all sorts of things to happen. I find it hard now to write a character without writing about their family or bringing the family into it. Once I get interested in a character, I start thinking about where they came from and who they are, who their parents were. For me, for the last few things I've done, it's always turned into a family context.
Yeah, because you describe Nourishment as a family novel as well.
I would describe it, yes, definitely. It's about a family under terrible stresses and extraordinary conditions.
And are you trying to move away from that now, what you're working on at the moment, or are you pursuing
it? I'm not consciously trying to avoid writing about family, but in the novel I'm working on at the moment, that is happening again, and it's turning into a more complicated novel. It's not just about an individual, it's about several stories running through the family that my central character is part of.
Mm. Lisa, I was wondering who you would cite as the great contemporary novelists of the family.
Well, I think if we're taking Gerard's definition of the family novel as the writer who gives us the point of view from different members of the family, one of them we can't not mention, Jonathan Franzen, who I think really found his subject with the American family, first with the Corrections and then with poor old Patty and Walter in Freedom. He really does the family from every angle and takes us through from their different viewpoints and takes us through the years. In this country as well, I mean, one thing that I love about the family novel, which Gerard does so wonderfully, is that it gives you a chance for trilogies and quartets and things. Well, I remember being sort of a bookish adolescent and absolutely loving this 16, I think there were, Jalna novels. And ever since then, I've sort of, a family saga gives you nice, good whack of books to get stuck into. Edward St. Aubyn has just done four with his Ghastly Melrose Family, which is just wonderful, I think. Slightly earlier, I loved A.S. Byatt's Frederica Porto Quartet, which I think, again, is sort of loosely based on her own family, sort of starting in Yorkshire and following her female character down to London.
I'm wondering if the rise of the memoir, with the revelation and self-explanation that the modern memoir now entails, has that shifted the world of the domestic novel, the family novel?
It's funny you should say that, because I'm just working this week on two big books. Just Jeanette Winterson has written her memoir, where Mrs. Winterson, her adoptive mother, it looms very large, and it's entirely wrestling with the family. And Jeanette, of course, loosely fictionalized that with Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. And now she has just gone straight for the memoir, and she talks a lot about the overlap between fiction and memoir and the truth and what it is to a writer and the silences. And I think she says at one point that the writer in a family has to speak from those silences, that it is sort of interrogating the gaps and the places of pain. And on the subject of pain, the other big family memoir that's out this week is Joan Didion's, her memoir about her daughter Quintana's death, following on from her memoir about her husband's death. So I think there is a sense that writers are maybe more comfortable discussing family in a memoir form.
Can you imagine coming back to your own history as fact?
It's interesting. I mean, there's been a lot of memoir writing recently, and I always find it a little bit disappointing when a novelist does it, you know, when a novelist writes their memoir. Because I'm just thinking, why don't you make a novel out of it? A novel's much more exciting than a memoir. It's
I think it's pulling the curtain aside and
much more
showing
truthful.
The workings.
Yes. The voice, somehow the memoir voice becomes very flat to me. You compare several different memoirs I've read recently. Michael Frayn was one. The voice, the narrative voice, is very different from the fictional narrative voice. And it's a lot flatter, just more sort of demotic and I don't know, it's just...
It's dressed down.
Yes, in a way. I just find there's a sort of flat sort of everydayness to it. What they can't do, really, aren't at liberty to do, is to recreate. You know, they can't create scenes to the extent you can as a novelist. You can just describe, you know, what you can recount what happened, but you can't really sort of make the scene come alive.
Tied down to memory.
Yeah.
Instead of liberated by it. So you're no plans to revisit in a different mode?
Well, I probably will write a memoir now that I've said all that. No, I'm always thinking, you know, what's left over from what I've fictionalised, and there's lots of stuff that's sort of still floating around in my mind. But hopefully that will make short stories and things and poems and all sorts of other stuff, use it to put in other novels, rather than sort of go back and sort of sweep up the remaining memories into a memoir of things I didn't manage to put in a novel.
Gerard Woodward there, talking to Richard Lee and Lisa Allardyce. One recent book about families that's been making a splash is the debut of Tennessee author Kevin Wilson. The Family Fang tells the story of siblings Annie and Buster and their eccentric performance artist parents Caleb and Camille.
On the plane ride back home, everyone again separated and under assumed names, their father once again nudged the stewardess, showed her the ring he had purchased for his girlfriend, and asked for the use of the intercom. Once again, the stewardess was nearly moved to tears by the romantic nature of the request and led him to the front of the plane. Buster tore open his 8th bag of peanuts and arranged the nuts so as to form the word "yes" on his folded down tray. "I'm over there in row 14, seat A, and my girlfriend, Grace Truman, is in the seat over. Grace, honey, could you come up here for a second, please?" Mrs. Fang shook her head, embarrassed, but Mr. Fang continued to call for her until she finally stood up and walked over to her husband. When she arrived, Mr. Fang dropped to a knee, opened the tiny box in his hand, and displayed the ring, her own wedding ring. Their 4 days in the sun had caused the tan line on her finger to disappear. "Grace Truman," their father said, "would you make me the happiest man in the world and marry me?" Annie was sketching a picture of onlookers throwing handfuls of peanuts into the air as a married couple walked down the aisle of a plane while she waited for her mother to answer. "Oh, Ronnie," Mrs. Fang said, looking like she might cry, "I told you not to do this." Their father looked uncomfortable to be kneeling for so long, but he would not stand. "Come on, honey, just say yes." Mrs. Fang looked away, but her husband raised the microphone to her face. "Just say yes into this microphone and make my dreams come true." Annie and Buster had no idea what was going on, but they both had the same sick feeling that things were about to get worse. "No, Ronnie," Mrs. Fang said, "I will not marry you." There were gasps from some passengers in the cabin, and their mother walked back to her seat, leaving their father on his knees, still holding the ring. After a few seconds, he stuttered into the microphone, "Well, folks, I'm sorry to take up so much of your time. I guess it just wasn't meant to be." He then stood and walked back to his seat beside their mother and sat down, neither one of them looking at the other. The rest of the flight was so tense and uncomfortable in the cabin that a plane crash would have been welcome to avoid the embarrassment of what had happened. In the car, driving home from the airport, the Fangs did not speak a single word. It had all been fake, a choreographed event, but they could not escape the dread that rattled inside their chests. It was a testament to their proficiency and talent as artists. They had affected themselves with the authenticity of the moment. Annie and Buster imagined a world where their parents had not married, had separated, and never returned to each other, a world in which, to their horror, they did not exist. Buster rested his head in Annie's lap as she stroked his hair. As they pulled into the long, winding driveway of their home in the woods, Mr. Fang finally pulled his wife close to him and whispered, "I love you, Grace Truman." Their mother kissed him on the cheek and responded, "I love you, Ronnie Payne." Annie leaned over her brother's open face and kissed him softly on the forehead. "I love you, Nick Fury," she said. He smiled and said, "I love you, Clara Bow." Even after the car was parked and the ignition turned off, the Fangs sat, their seatbelts still fastened, and allowed the world to turn without any help from the four of them.
The Family Fang is about the dangers involved in making art, so when Richard met Kevin, he asked him whether anyone got hurt in the making of the book.
Just me. That was it. I limited it solely to myself.
Kept the damage tightly around you.
Yeah, but I did ruin myself quite a bit in the writing of it, but I stayed down in my basement and I made sure nobody else was harmed.
I was wondering if it's more of a kind of extended apology to your own family for your artistic endeavours, or indeed a kind of book-length rejection of Cyril Connolly's characterization of the pram in the hall as the somber enemy of good art.
I hope that, you know, it serves as an explanation to my son when he's older of what art can be and what I hope it wasn't for him. Without knowing whether or not that's true, he'll tell me, I guess. But this was one possibility. Or maybe it's to show my son when he gets older to say, at least it wasn't this bad. You shouldn't be complaining.
I see, because I mean, in the book, there's this kind of intergenerational conflict between Caleb and Camille Fang, the parents, who are producing these artistic events in shopping malls all over America, and destroying the psychological well-being of their children, Buster and Annie, in the process. Did you suffer from wacky parents yourself?
My father was the captain of the football team. He was the high school president. My mom was a cheerleader and a prom queen. They were the most popular people in school, and yet they were deeply weird underneath that. They had this mask of normalcy, and then when they were alone, they were strange people. And so when we were born, my sister and I, they seemed normal to everyone else, but in our house, it was bizarre. They let us be superheroes all the time. They were narrating our lives as if we were superheroes. They would help us make stop motion movies. They let us do whatever we wanted, and never once did I ever hear them tell us that we couldn't or that it was strange to do that. And they actively encouraged it. And they also told us that when we got older, we would go out into the real world and it would be so much worse than what it was now. They let us know that what we were experiencing was not the norm, and to appreciate it, because when we got older, it would be not as much fun.
Was this a prediction that's been borne out? Have you found yourself looking back on your childhood as a kind of golden era of fun and frolics?
It was pretty wonderful, and the real world is pretty awful. So I think they were correct in a lot of ways, that when you're a kid and when you have parents that allow you to do whatever you want, it's a kind of freedom that you'll never get back. And for Annie and Buster and Caleb and Camille, they continue that. They never get away from that. They just continue to create strangeness as the older and older that they get. And I'm just not, maybe perhaps not brave enough to continue doing that. As much as I loved that childhood and being able to do whatever I wanted in the name of fun or in the name of art, that's just not how I can live. I'm too anxious to do that.
But nevertheless, you've turned yourself into a writer who's producing these extraordinary books. Do you trace that freedom, that ability to explore an imaginative world, back to the freedom you had as a child?
Yeah, I mean, it was my parents that encouraged narrative. They encouraged the stranger the story that you could make up, the better it was. And we all did that. We all created strange stories for who we were and identities for ourselves, and my parents loved that stuff. So it became a game to see who could tell the best story. And so when I got older, it just seemed natural to just continue telling stories.
There's an opposition in the book between the kind of experimental, the raw art made by Caleb and Camille and the kind of more mainstream path chosen by Annie and Buster. There's the House of Swans wins the coveted Golden Quill Award, and Date Due is nominated for an Oscar. I mean, which side are you on?
Well, I mean, I appreciate that kind of art that disrupts and that is chaotic and that even creates the question of what can and cannot be art. I think that stuff is really incredible, but I can't do it. It's crazy making to me to try to create that kind of stuff. It requires you to push yourself into the world in a way that I can't do. I'm too nervous to do that. And so writing allows me the ability to create something however I want it to be without having to interact with the world on some level. So I appreciate the more standard forms of art. At the same time, maybe I wish that I could do that stranger, more chaotic art.
You're pretty brutal with your characters, though. I mean, Buster's hospitalized within the first couple of chapters, and Annie's career is heading off the rails shortly thereafter. Do you enjoy taking this kind of violent engagement to your characters with your fictional creations?
Well, I think that for me, if somebody is sinking underneath the surface of water, the instinct is to climb back up to the surface, to swim back up, to get your head above water. And for some reason, I don't do that. I think that it's better to just swim deeper and deeper and see what happens. And so that's what these characters do when they get into a bad situation. I like to push them further and further away from happiness and see if maybe you can go so far on the other end that you end up happier than you would have been otherwise. I hope I get them to a safe place at the end, but I try and get them there through the weirdest possible way.
You also seem to have a thing about Mortal Kombat. Is there a kind of video games nerd at the back of your head somewhere?
It's the greatest thing that I have ever seen is the game Mortal Kombat. And I was 13 years old when it came out, and I had never seen anything like it. And it occupied every waking hour, this game where people punched each other into comas and ripped people's heads off and pulled out their hearts. And I don't know why it appealed to me, but that game was just incredible. And partly it was because we weren't supposed to play it. But partly it was just watching that action. And then, thankfully, I was able to figure out a way to get it into a story. I was like, maybe I can use this as a metaphor, which is probably maybe the worst idea, to try and turn a video game into a metaphor. But I tried to do it.
I was wondering if you had any worries about putting a novelist into a novel, any worries about the book eating itself in some ways as we follow Buster struggling with his work.
Yeah, it's just maybe it's that I don't know how to write anybody else, but I figured I could at least understand a writer who was struggling to write another book. If I can keep the characters close enough to myself, then I can figure them out more easily and then figure out how to make them different from me. So with Buster, the way into it was the writing, that he's trying to write and he's not successful in some ways. It was an initial worry, but it was the only way I could figure out how to get into the narrative.
You said that your childhood, your freedom that your parents offered you in your childhood was a kind of wonderful thing and was something that let you delve into your kind of experimental soul and carry on making stories. Have you chosen to give your own child, Griff, the similar kind of freedoms?
Yeah, and part of that is because where we live in a cabin out in the woods in a very small town and out in the middle of nowhere place. And so we're constantly living in this solitude. And so it's just my wife and my son and myself in this cabin. And so we have to think of ways to keep ourselves occupied without going crazy. And so the way that we do that is we create games, we create strangeness. And our son has taken to that pretty well. He loves narrative. He loves creating characters for himself. And so, you know, I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a world for him where everything is safe, everything is possible, and everything is weird, and then just hope that that works out for us. We're going to let him explore whatever he wants to and just see if that ends up making a kind of correct adult.
Richard Lee talking to Kevin Wilson about his novel, The Family Fan. The children in Kevin's novel moved away to escape their parents. But what if your parents are very famous? There's no escaping their legacy. Stefan Solzhenitsyn grew up the son of one of the most notorious figures in Russian literature. Alexander Solzhenitsyn helped make the world aware of the Soviet gulags and was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1970. On Thursday, a new collection of Solzhenitsyn's short stories, Apricot Jam and Other Stories, is released. Written in the years after Solzhenitsyn's return from exile to Russia in 1994, the stories were part translated by his son Stefan. Richard Lee met Stefan and asked him why, after monumental works such as The Gulag Archipelago, his father decided to return to shorter fiction in later life.
He very much wanted to return to the short form. He was always an admirer of the short form. It's something he found himself able to do once again after he returned to Russia. Something about the air and soil of your home country that makes you able to do.
What was it like for him to come back to find Russia in such a state?
It was very difficult for him. He cared deeply about how Russia would come out of communism. He was sure that there was a good and a bad way out. He was confident that there would need to be a way out. And he surely thought that Russia went by far not the best possible way out and possibly one of the worst ways out. He was distraught over it. And I think he was distraught over it until the day he died.
Some of those in the West who had supported him with his criticism of the Soviet regime and then themselves were very pleased to see Gorbachev and Yeltsin come in and, as they saw it, change things around, were surprised to see him giving backing to someone like Vladimir Putin. What do you think he made of the new Russia?
I think that all of those views, all the views you just mentioned, are reduced to politics. The disaster of the 90s was a disaster, but not because Yeltsin was in power. The disaster of the 90s was because people were dispossessed, impoverished, greatly injured, and then much insult was added to that injury. That was his problem with it. With Putin, he met him twice. Putin once asked to come and visit, and then another time Putin awarded him a prize that the Russian Academy of Sciences had bestowed on my father. But he was never a politician. He was a writer.
What was it like for you to work on the translations of your father's work?
Translating is always, it's always hard work, and it's always enthralling. You are in the thick of the language in a way that no reader usually is. You are a co-author in some ways. You have to read the text so much closer, and you have to think about it so much closer, and you have to live with it. You wake up in the mornings thinking about a better, more proper way of saying something, a phrase, a combination. So it becomes absolutely a part of you and your very fabric.
Clearly you don't have something to compare it with, but do you think that you know your father in some sense better because you've read his work?
I think yes, absolutely. Personally, I always knew him as dad. I knew him as my father. But I did not actually believe when I was very little. I did not believe what my grandmother and my mother told me, that don't you understand who your father is? And I sort of, and I actually was sure that that's a ruse. I was sure that all little kids get told that their father is somebody important or somebody amazing. And obviously, so I was actually quite skeptical. For me, it was a long journey of discovery into adolescence to actually understand the magnitude of the man as an author. The writers, they don't have to change, but we as readers change. So we will understand. I, as a reader, understand my father, not just reading these short stories, but rereading something he wrote once, because I'm changing as a reader, and that's the great gift that literature gives us all. We grow up with it, and it's a reflection of us, not just of what the author has given us.
That's the conjuring trick of all literature, isn't it? Is that in some sense, with a book, you feel that you are inhabiting somebody else's mind. Yes. What is that like for somebody who the other person's mind is in fact also your father?
It's not his mind or the author's mind that I think. I would say that the most successful writers are those where it's not, it's not Hemingway, right? It's the characters. It's not Dickens. It's the characters. I think when I read these short stories, I think of Pavel Ektov. See, that's whose mind, right? Or I think of these two different Nastinkas. That's whose mind.
You say that as a child you didn't kind of believe that he was really that famous. But was it like growing up in a household with a literary legend? Was it kind of a wacky bohemian household?
There was bohemian is not the word I would describe it. But you know what it was? It felt like happy, busy. Everybody was a happy, busy bee. It was a very happy time. My father and with my mother helping him quite a bit. They were a team, and we were also a part of the team. There were tasks to be done, little things that we could do, and it's such a kick to be a part of your dad's work. They have these. I don't know if they have them in the UK. Take your kids to work day. Every day for me was take your kids to work day. It was great, and it was extremely happy. It was a fusion of life, of play, and of work.
That's tremendously valuable. Did he see himself as a kind of famous writer, like the writer in the first story? Did he worry about getting cut off by this fame from proper humanity?
He very much thought that the thing a writer has to do is actually right. In his case, exile was in fact a great challenge, because exile meant that he could not speak. He could not speak directly, hear from his reader directly. But it so turned out that what he was actually doing, he was, in a sense, he was not living, I would say, in the United States or in Vermont. He was living in St. Petersburg or in Petrograd in 1917. There was so much to be done there that was his station at that point in life. Clearly, he does not view the kind of writer you have here in Apricot Jam, widely recognized, although not named as Alexei Tolstoy. The kind of self-preoccupation that writer has is... clearly an example, I think, to my father at least, clearly was of a writer who's not focusing on what is most essential and on what is true.
Do you feel a duty to look after his legacy?
Surely, in a healthy way. I think that his legacy is far greater than anything I can look after or tend to. But I do certainly, I would say I feel a privilege to be part of his legacy, maybe a better way to do it. I certainly think it is important and it is relevant that newer readers and entire generations of readers get a chance to read him and with each passing year, we will all be reading him more as a writer, and it'll be less and less of the kind of political questions kind of clouding our judgment, because we will be taking really the most essential things away.
How is he seen now in Russia?
Well, he's in the school program, which I say is always both a good and a bad thing in a sense, because it means that kids, once you're in the school program, you run the risk of being part of officialdom to the kids. But of course, it is a fantastic thing that at the end of the day that he's in the school program, especially that the Gulag Archipelago is in the school program. It means that such an essential part of our past is delivered in a way that is not textbook dry, boring, put you to sleep, or think that those nightmares are for another time and another, not for me.
So in a way,
that actually
make
it relevant,
make
it relevant. So the fact that the Gulag Archipelago, for example, is in the school program to me is extremely significant.
Apricot Jam and Other Stories is out this week, and that's it from us today. Elsewhere on Guardian Books, in Saturday Review carrying on the family theme, Jeanette Winterson is talking about her new memoir, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, which picks up where oranges are not the only fruit left off. The profile this week is Christopher Reed, and Safraz Manzoor is rereading Black Like Me. In The Observer on Sunday, Rachel Cook is talking about the history of British food, and Peter Conrad reviews the new biography of Steve Jobs. And on the website, we have Alexandra Fuller's Top 10 African Memoirs, a gallery of J.R.R. Tolkien's own illustrations for The Hobbit, and a quiz on motorways and literature to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the M25. Thanks to Kevin Wilson, Stefan Solzhenitsyn and Jared Woodward, Richard Lee and Lisa Allardyce, and to our producer, Simon Barnard. I'm Sarah Crown. Goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.